Welcome to another episode of the Richards Report. I'm Ted Richards. What a guest we have for this episode. Scott Galloway is back on after I caught up with him in New York last year. For those that haven't listened to that episode or you're not familiar with Scott, he's a professor of marketing at NYU Stern, serial entrepreneur and author of the fantastic book, Post Corona. In this episode, we cover the accelerated digital disruption and how it's impacting everything from retail, education, and investing. We touch on how stimulus packages may be fueling income inequality in the US, and importantly, what Scott thinks is a potential solution to the situation we now find ourselves in, what we find ourselves in. As always, the usual disclosures, this episode is just for educational purposes only and does not qualify as financial advice, and people may hold in the companies discussed. And as always, for episode show notes, go to sixpark.com.au, sixpark.com.au. Thanks to everyone that listens in. Make sure you subscribe. And for those open to giving Christmas presents, I'd really appreciate a ratings on iTunes if you've got a spare 60 seconds. You can probably do it right now while you're listening in. Okay, let's get into it. With no further ado, here is my discussion with the big dog, Scott Galloway.
You're listening to The Richards Report, where we will speak with investment experts from around the country. We will cut through the jargon to allow you to make more insightful investment decisions for your future. This is The Richards Report.
Welcome back to another episode of The Richards Report. I'm here with Professor of Marketing at NYU Stern, serial entrepreneur and author of the fantastic book, Post Corona. Scott Galloway, welcome back to the Richards Report.
Thanks very much. Good to see you. What a thrill. What a thrill.
Last time we caught up, it was in New York. It has only been 12 months, Scott, since we last caught up. Hasn't a lot changed. Of course, we're going to speak about the global pandemic and what that means for business and the economy. But Scott, I'm not sure if you recall, we had a brief chat after recording when the microphone was off last time about an Aussie business you were keen to learn about, and that's Afterpay. Do you remember that little chat we had?
Yeah, I heard they're doing okay. I heard those guys are doing okay for themselves.
Yeah, well,
cottage business.
Yeah. Well, I did listen to your recent episode of the Prof G Show, where you actually interviewed Nick Molnar. I went back to kind of look at where the share price was when we had the conversation. And back in November, it was around $30, to be fair. In March of this year, it dropped down to around $12. But now we're at the time of recording, it's up to about $100. So just that company alone, what a roller coaster that's been.
Yeah, they're an incredible story. They went public and a lot of people asked me what I thought of it. And I said, I didn't see the barriers of entry. And I thought that Visa and MasterCard were going to come along and that the stock would come under pressure or attract competition. And then the stock started going down and I thought, oh, I'm a genius. And then the thing's ripped back. It's now got a market capitalization of almost $30 billion. So, I mean, he seems like a really nice kid too. He's your age. He's 30 years old. It's an inspiring story. They've done incredibly well. I think there's another firm, a similar firm called Affirm, going public.
Yep. There's Klarna in Sweden.
Is that right? Yeah. I'm not familiar with them. But yeah, good for them. Good for you guys. Good for Australia.
So many businesses that we could speak about and have a whole show in itself. Like, for example, Kodak. what a 12 months it's been for that business. But before we get into what is likely to happen in 2021 and discuss some of the themes and topics you mentioned in your book, I just want to maybe start off with 2020. And it's been a historic year that we're going to look back on. Mm-hmm. Can you quantify in years approximately the rate of adoption that has occurred over the last 10 months to give listeners a bit of context?
Yeah, so COVID 19 will be remembered more as an accelerant than a change agent. And that is the trends that were already in place don't seem to really appear. There's some things that have, some rivers that have reversed. There was kind of, it appears as if the migration into cities has been temporarily cauterized. But there really is, if you think of this will be known as the great acceleration. And that is, as an example, and I think this is the best example, e-commerce kind of started taking root in 2000, and every year as a percentage of total retail gained about 1 percentage point. So we sat here in March of 2020 at 18 points of e-commerce in the U.S. What is it in Australia? What percentage of retail is done through e-commerce channels in Australia?
Oh, I wish I could answer that. I'm not sure.
So I think I would imagine it's somewhat similar. But anyways, we sat here at 18%, and then
it would be well under the U.S.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
And then 8 weeks into the pandemic, it jumped to 28. So we had 10 years of acceleration in e-commerce in 8 weeks. We've seen the same thing across online grocery. We've seen the same thing. We've leapt a decade in terms of work from home. Again, more people were working from home. It was steadily increasing. But also across negative trends. So income inequality was accelerating, and now it's gone parabolic. There are now more young adults between the ages of 18 and 13 in the U.S. living at home with their parents and living on their own. Again, that was increasing, but it's dramatically increased. So it's actually an interesting exercise, and that is take the three biggest trends in your business and then the three biggest trends, if you will, in your life, and take them out 10 years and ask yourself, are we there now? And we just don't realize it. So anyways, COVID-19, the great accelerant.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's interesting to possibly how much has accelerated over the last 10 months. Wonder how much more is still to come over the next 12 months. What you were mentioning before about the rate of e-commerce in Australia, mm-hmm. the reason why I know it's probably greater in the US than it is in Australia, in that I saw a chart the other day showing some stats on US households in 2020. 68% own a pet, 77 decorate a Christmas tree, and 82% are Amazon Prime members. And the listeners of this show are predominantly Australian, and Amazon Prime isn't here in Australia like it is in the US. So mm-hmm. I was wondering if we could speak about Amazon for a while. Mm-hmm. Is there a company that will come out post-corona better than Amazon?
It's hard to imagine. If you look at the big four, Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google, Facebook and Google took a bit of a hit. Advertisers did decrease their spending. Google registered its first quarter-on-quarter yearly decline. But their business has ripped back as the culling of media properties, if you will, means that there's more foliage for fewer elephants when the rains return. And they're going to go from 60 cents on the dollar to 80 cents on the digital dollar here in the U.S. So they had a bit of a dip. Apple has seen its revenues go flat and then start to slowly increase, but its stock has doubled because it's moved to recurring revenue. The company that has accelerated through the pandemic and looks as if it was invented for a pandemic is Amazon. And so look at the major businesses. We have e-commerce. We've dispersed retail to the home. E-commerce has accelerated or leapt a decade, which benefits the player that has between 30 and 50% e-commerce share, depending on what market you're talking about. We're at home. We're working remotely, which means we need more storage and more processing power. That's AWS. That business is exploding. They have Amazon Fulfillment. They have Amazon Marketplace. Oh, and what are we doing at home? We're watching more original scripted television. They have the third or fourth most popular streaming network in Amazon Prime Video. It's literally as if Jeff Bezos had a crystal ball and said, I'm going to invent a company to serve people should they decide to live at home for 6 months. So the company has added more market capitalization since its lows in March than all of European retail. So add up every retailer in Europe, and I think every retailer in Africa now, and that's how much market capitalization Amazon has added. It's really difficult to imagine a company that's firing on all 12,000 cylinders like Amazon is. And I would argue over the next couple of years, it'll become the fastest growing $1 billion plus healthcare company. I think they're clearly lining up around healthcare. So Amazon is just, it feels almost unstoppable at this point.
Firing on 12,000 cylinders. As an example, I saw an article in the New York Times that said Amazon is hiring 1,400 new staff per day, which is huge. And like I said at the start, Australia and the US, we are so similar in many ways, but that is one area where you are further advanced in terms of uptake of Amazon Prime. I'd say there's no chance that there'd be more than, say, 10% of Aussies that are an Amazon Prime member. So it's certainly where we're heading, though.
Yeah, it'll happen. It's And I, you know, my advice to Australia would be to try and keep Amazon at bay, because the 1,400 people a day. What's interesting is if you look at the past month, and again, the two aren't correlated and one hasn't caused the other, but there's about 1,400 people on average a day dying in America from COVID-19. And I want to be clear, Amazon, I think, is a good employer. They raise the minimum wage in the U.S. to $15 an hour. They hire, they're the largest recruiter out of my business school class, and jobs, especially at HQ, are good jobs. But what gets missed in that data is vastly more than 1,400 people are being fired or laid off every day in the world of retail, because Amazon is just more efficient. It's very hard to compete with Amazon. They do a great job, I would argue. And this isn't in and among itself a bad thing. Amazon, I would argue, as our most innovative firms, kind of a job destroyer, or they force people to go get new skills. But there's just no getting around it. Amazon is now the second largest private employer in America behind a Walmart, with about, it took them about 25 years to get to 500,000 employees, and then took them, again, back to the theme of acceleration, it took them 12 months to go from 500,000 to 1,000,000. But the scale of hiring is incredible. I think it's great. I think they'd hire more people if they were broken up, which I'm an advocate of. But yeah, the scale of Amazon is just spectacular. And what people don't realize is the scale of Jeff Bezos' wealth. I spent a lot of time meeting with elected representatives in D.C., and they've heard my rap, Tim. They know I want them to be broken up, that they're too powerful, monopoly power, you know, blah, blah, blah. They're like, Scott, we've heard it. What they usually don't understand is the scale. So Jeff Bezos is now worth more, him individually, than every citizen in Vermont, Wyoming, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. combined. And in a good week, he will add the value of every, he will add the wealth of every citizen in North and South Dakota. So imagine an individual in Australia that on a good week adds Tasmania. Like all the wealth of Tasmania gets added to one man. And then the next week, maybe a good year, he adds the value of Perth. I mean, that's the kind of wealth we're talking about. He could buy Ferrari, Land Rover, Jaguar, actually they're owned by the same company. He could buy every Premier League soccer team, every NBA team, the Pan Am building, Boeing, Airbus, Carnival Cruises, and still have enough money left over to buy Richemont if he wants nice watches. I mean, just the scale of wealth here, and wealth on its own, there's nothing wrong with being a billionaire. We need billionaires. But the thing that I think we're struggling with is right now in the U.S., 1 in 5 households with kids are food insecure. So it's like, okay, is our ecosystem working? And I think we're trying to figure out if this is if things have gotten a little bit out of control, if you will.
We're going to speak to income inequality shortly. Keeping it back in Australia, I just want to touch on one thing. Actually, I'm going to ask you a question, Scott. Australia's largest export is iron ore.
Yeah.
Second is coal. A question without notice. What do you reckon is next? And I'll give you a hint. It's an area that you're very well versed in.
Gosh. From Australia?
It's education.
Oh, no kidding. The biggest export?
Yep. Yeah, we have.
In what format? How are you guys doing that? Through online or through universities or
through universities? We get a lot of people coming from overseas, especially Asia and China, to study our universities, in particular in Melbourne and Sydney. So let's have a quick chat about education, as it's important to us. You're a professor at NYU, and you've also set up Section 4. A business education company, and you did this well in advance of COVID, which is incredible foresight to see the opportunity here. You're incredibly
That's just luck, boss.
Okay, well, you're incredibly well qualified to answer this question, as you have experience both in face-to-face traditional education and also non-traditional online education. Scott, as an Australian, with our third largest export being education, what do you think the future of tertiary education will look like?
So I think it's a really interesting question. I think in Australia, your education costs haven't skyrocketed. They've skyrocketed on a proportional basis, but it's still my understanding. So where I teach at NYU, the tuition is about $62,000 a year. That's just tuition before room and board. So if you're sending a kid to undergrad at NYU, it's not unreasonable to think you need $400,000 in post-tax income. So that's a pretty serious check. And my sense, and correct me if I'm wrong, my sense is that university in Australia has gotten much more expensive, but it's still not on that scale. Is that correct? Is that a correct assumption?
That is a correct assumption, and possibly why we get the people coming to us, because we've still got a world-recognized education system that doesn't require the cost that it does in the US.
The other reason why people come to Australia is because, simply put, 18-year-olds get to have a say. And, you know, would you rather be in Shenzhen or Melbourne? I mean, it's just, there's just very few people in Asia that think, oh, I wouldn't like to roll in Australia for 4 years. And the same thing, a lot of people globally think, I'd love to spend time in Soho or New York for 4 years. So if you think about it, education in Australia or in the US is kind of the ultimate luxury item. It's super expensive. It's super high margin. It also signals that you're a successful family. If you say, my daughter is in school in Melbourne, or my daughter's in school in San Francisco, it kind of says something about your success. And so it really is a luxury item. It's tremendously lucrative is the wrong word, but we have about 14% of our students are international students, but they had their first time international students enrollment this fall has declined by 44%. The number of total international students has declined, I think, 15%. We have 400,000 of them each year in the U.S. And they're an incredible asset for the U.S., as I imagine there are for Australia. They do a few things. One, crudely speaking, they're our cash cows. We say that we bring them in for diversity. We bring them in because they pay full freight. They pay the full sticker price. They estimate about 400,000 academics. Their jobs are totally reliant on the cash we get from international students. Two, in the U.S., we have really mediocre K-12 education, but we have outstanding universities. And a big part of that is that 50% of the people pursuing PhDs or doctorates are foreign-born or immigrants, so H-1B visas. And two, if you just look at innovation, look at 60% of the NASDAQ by dollar volume or by market cap is run by people who are either first or second generation immigrants. Yeah, I mean, MasterCard, Adobe, Microsoft, all of these companies are run by, in this case, just Indians that immigrated to America. So, you know, you might ask, well, why are Americans being so xenophobic and anti-immigrant? We shouldn't be. It's kind of our secret sauce. You played sports. Imagine a rugby team that every college in the world, I don't know what the feeders are, if it's college or lower tier rugby teams, but say every player wanted to play for that one team, and then you decided, no, you're not welcome here. I mean, we just get such incredible human talent, and it sounds like Australia does. And what happens is that when a Chinese national comes to school in Melbourne or in New York, they typically want to stay for a little while. They typically decide, you know what, life is pretty good here. And I like the idea of hanging out here. And what do? They get their degree. They work hard. Sometimes they start businesses. They bring family over. They fall in love. They get married. And it's kind of the secret sauce. So Australia was, I mean, what Australia and the U.S. have in common is that we are largely a nation of immigrants, you could argue. Now, a lot of people would say, well, that just reflects the ugly white man ignoring the native population. And I think there's an interesting conversation around that, but there's just no denying our secret sauce in America, and I also think in Australia, is that it's just got such a wonderful quality of life, and it's traditionally been so open and accepting of immigrants. It's kind of our secret sauce, right? It's like having the number one draft choice every year if you're a rugby or a basketball team. We get the best people in the world. So it doesn't surprise me. It's a huge industry for you. It's a huge industry for us. You guys just – I don't know if there – I know that you have a bit of a nationalism – kind of thread running through your society right now, but we've gone full, at least until this election, we're becoming very hostile towards immigrants, and it just makes no sense. It's just shooting yourself in the foot. But education, fantastic business, $7 trillion business, growing faster and faster. I think it's about to be disrupted in the U.S. I don't know about Australia, but there's a recognition it's gotten too expensive, and it really hasn't improved much.
This episode is brought to you by Six Park. At Six Park, we provide professional investment management, and it's all done online. we first take you through a risk assessment to determine your risk profile, and we provide you with an investment recommendation according to your risk profile. Clients are diversified across multiple asset classes, from Australian and international equities, bonds, infrastructure, global property, and overseen by the Six Park Investment Committee, which includes Brian Watson, a former member of the Board of Guardians for the Australian Government Future Fund, Lindsay Tanner, the former Minister of Finance for the Australian Government, and Mark Nicholson, who headed up an investment division of the World Bank. Six Park clients receive this level of oversight for their portfolio, with fees starting from just $9.95 a month. To find out more, go to sixpark.com.au. Back to the discussion with Scott.
Let's move from education into another topic. We're in a recession, or we've just been through one. Who knows? We'll only know after the fact. But there's some behavior going on that I guess many of us weren't expecting to play out in a recession. And that is the savings rate has never been higher. On one hand, that's great, but not everyone is doing smart things with their cash. An example of this is some Robin Hood investors are really dialing up the risk, which is, to be fair, it works well in a rising market. I just want to kind of have a quick chat about that. What's your view on the rise of these Robin Hood investors, and how do you think they're going to fare post-corona?
Well, it's a really strange phenomena. If you had told me that we were about to experience the worst crisis since World War II for Western economies, and then you said, okay, how do you think the markets are going to do? You probably wouldn't have said, oh, they're going to rip up. You would have said, well, that's going to be bad for everybody, as it sort of should be. And the answer is the S&P just hit an all-time high. Tesla's up fivefold. If you had $100 of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google stock at the beginning of the year, you're up 54% year to date. So the question is, how's this happened? And at least in the U.S., it's been a function of a few things. One, record stimulus, pumping money into the economy. And we've sort of pumped it. You could argue it's been an egalitarian stimulus. But when you have the savings rates at all-time highs, I would argue that you probably didn't get the money to people who needed it, or you got the money to a lot of people who, quite frankly, didn't need it. We had a big bailout program here that cost $750 billion called PPP, which is basically a bailout of small businesses. And the wealthiest cohort in America are small business owners. So if you're a business owner and you get $1 million bailout for your company to not lay off employees and you weren't planning to anyways, or you're a 22-year-old male living at home in your parents' basement and you get a $1,200 stimulus check, you put it into the market. Maybe you don't need it. Mom's cooking all your meals. You have a company that's thriving. You put it into the market. And so what we've seen is just an explosion in the value of stocks, but not just any stocks, story stocks. So these investors love the sugar high of the companies they see on CNBC and read in the Wall Street Journal, the Zooms, the Pelotons, the Teslas, the Apples, the Amazons. And those stocks have skyrocketed. And even though the market is all-time high, if you look back since the outbreak of the pandemic, about 90 to 95% of the gains in the market since then, the unprecedented gains, can be explained or justified by 7 to 10 stocks. So it's essentially, these 7 stocks and then the rest, the 493 other S&P 500. If you took those companies out, the S&P would be down. So it's not only that we've massively stimulated the economy with money that our kids and grandkids will have to pay back, which I don't think is a good thing, but it's also crowding or accreting to the wealthy, because somewhere between 80 and 90% of the value of the stock market is owned by the top 10%. So what do we have? We're borrowing money against the future, and we're using it to stimulate the economy. A lot of it didn't stimulate the economy, but went into the stock market, and who benefits from increases in asset prices, because 80 to 90% of assets by value are owned by the top 10%. So we've seen, just as we had income inequality previous to this that was dysfunctional, it's now become dystopian. And that is, the top 1% in America have made more money in the last 6 months grown their wealth more than any 6-month period in history. And it kind of comes down to this question that when we face a crisis, is that really what we want? This crisis is very expensive. We're in the U.S., it's going to cost us $2 to $3 trillion in debt. And then you have the wealthiest Americans growing their wealth in an unprecedented fashion. It's like, well, okay, is that how this should have played out? Meanwhile, we have tremendous strain on kind of middle and lower income families. So I would argue America is a terrible example of what to do. And I'd be curious to know how you believe or how you think Australia has responded to this. But in America, we've kind of decided to protect companies and protect wealthy people, as opposed to just protecting people or the most vulnerable. I think we're going to go down. I think this response is going to be seen as really the wrong approach, where we protected companies, not people. How are things unfolding in Australia around these kind of rescue packages?
There were two main rescue packages, I guess, would be JobKeeper, which is one which created a guaranteed income for people that, as part of a business that had incurred a drop in revenue of 30% or more. And the other was JobSeeker for people that were currently out of work. Both of those income supplements were dialed up. Mm-hmm. And to be fair, the government had to kind of come up with these very quickly. So
yeah,
I think they're aware they're not perfect, but it was to try and ensure that it wasn't like, say, through the financial crisis where large businesses received all these supporting things. Mm-hmm. Only in time will we see whether that's worked, because certainly many other policies they had to come up with very quickly to ensure that people didn't fall through the cracks. And
yep,
it wasn't perfect, because there were so many businesses, in particular, you know, startups and all these things that didn't receive the same support that other businesses did. But I think on the whole, they have done quite well. Mm-hmm. We're going to chat about income inequality next, but I just want to go back to that Robin Hood retail trader.
Oh yeah,
investing. Sorry about that. Oh no, investing in story stocks, because it is a behavior that is really interesting. In that, with story stocks, valuation doesn't seem to come into it so much. And I read a fantastic article in the Wall Street Journal by Jason Zweig about him getting into Robin Hood and how some of these behavioral things that they've built into the platform made it hard for him to stop trading. So have you tried it out?
I've looked at it. I don't have an account. I'm actually invested in a competitor, because I think Robinhood. So let's look at Facebook. Facebook has purposely engineered into their product certain gamification, certain behavioral triggers that result in a certain level of addiction. Like, okay, do people like me? All right, endless scroll. Visual cues that keep pinging kind of my lizard brain and releasing DOPA. And Robinhood took a page out of that playbook and said, all right, what if we have visual stimulation every time you buy a stock? What if we ask you to tap this button 100 times to unlock a low interest rate checking account? What if we figure out a way to create sort of a gamification, make it feel like a game? And the result is Robinhood has attracted a lot of young men, many of whom are probably not working, many of whom are bored, many of whom have a stimulus check. And I would argue they're not investing, they're gambling. So the number of options traded on the Robinhood platform relative to other online trading platforms is 88 times greater on a proportional basis. So you have people levering up with margin, trading kind of these really dangerous exotic instruments, kind of these weapons of mass destruction if you're not careful. And they've been going into, again, the story stocks, which has been inflating the market. Supposedly, volume, Robinhood went down for a short while last week, and supposedly when that happened, trading volume was off 30%. So, look, I think investing in stocks as a young person is a great way to learn. I think it's a great way to create wealth. But I think when you start trying to tickle people's tribal or their gaming sensors, or try and get them hooked on the short-term hit of norepinephrine or DOPA, I think it's dangerous. And what's clear with Robinhood is they don't see the people on their platform as their consumer. They see them as the product. So the purpose is to get you hooked, free trading, and then they sell your order flow to hedge funds that either want to front-run the trade or want to bet against it, because to date they've shown that people who are investing, Robinhood investors, aren't very sophisticated. There was a story a few weeks ago that people who found out someone had hacked their Robinhood account and were actually in the process of transferring money out, you couldn't get a live person on the phone at Robinhood. and you got an automatically generated email saying someone will be back to you in the next several weeks. So it's clear that you're the product of Robinhood. You're a corpus to be mined of data that they can monetize somewhere else. And then most tragically, a 20-year-old named Alex Kearns got an errant message saying that he was down $750,000. And he literally took it as, I have no way out. My parents can't afford this. I can't afford this. And he decided to throw himself in front of a train. And the response from Robinhood was to donate $250,000 to a mental health foundation and commit to hiring an options specialist. In other words, they haven't done anything. So if we could go back in time and say, all right, Facebook is addicting young people, and there's a lot of negative externalities, what would we do about it? And I would argue we would probably do something about it. As a matter of fact, today the New York State Attorney General has announced an action on behalf of 48 states to break up Facebook. I think that's where we are with Robinhood. I think Robinhood is a menace. I think that they're willing to sacrifice the mental health and the financial health of young people in exchange for shareholder value. And I'm a capitalist. You know, I believe that people have to be responsible for their own decisions. But when you purposely build in these very addictive attributes and you're appealing to younger men's sort of worst instincts and you're talking about financial future, you're talking about addiction, I think there just needs to be more regulation. So I'm not a big fan of Robinhood, as you can imagine. I think it's dangerous. I think it's terrible for young people. And I think the management and the board there lack code. I think they see us as their traders as, you know, sheep to be pumped full of hormones until they're ready for slaughter. I just don't think it's a very consumer-friendly approach.
I'm involved with a robo-advisor in Australia called Six Park, which you might be familiar with, Betterment or mm-hmm. Wealthfront. And I see benefit in the advice piece. And we've made a conscious decision to mute the colors, the greens mm-hmm. and the reds, to step away from those addictive attributes, which you touched on, which it's part of who we are, that we get excited by the greens and the reds stress us. So just strip that out. And because we don't want people to be, if you're investing in the long term, we don't want people to be on a roller coaster day to day.
I think that's right.
Let's go over to income inequality, which we've touched on a couple of times. Last episode, I had a chat with Morgan Housel on the show, and he spoke about what happened in the US in the 70s and 80s. And that's mm-hmm. where he viewed the income inequality really started to rise, where large amounts of people started to take on debt to keep up with others, you know, in the mm-hmm. community. And you reference in your book that capitalism is broken. I'm interested, Scott, are there any kind of key moments that you can think of where it started to kind of break and go wrong?
That's interesting. I don't know if there was a single moment. I think it's been incremental, but
yep.
I think if you just look at the data, in the 60s, the wealthy paid 50 to 60%. In the 70s, they paid upwards of 70 or 80% of their income in taxes. There was a general viewpoint that you cut off the tops of trees such that the saplings could get more sunlight. The wealthy now pay 20% or the top 0.1%, the super wealthy. They're paying their lowest taxes in history. Corporate profits are at an all-time high, but wages have stayed flat. So some of this is market dynamics, but a lot of it is our personal choice around fiscal and monetary policy, where we've said our collective goal as Americans, if you look at our monetary and fiscal policy and our laws, is to find remarkable people and turn them into billionaires. And you could argue that's maybe a way we should roll and then hope that the billionaires put us on Mars, find vaccines, are generous, fund hospitals. That's what I would call the Pablo Escobar strategy, where he built parks. And, you know, in some ways it was good for the economy to bring all that outside money into the Colombian economy. We used to be kind of in love with the unremarkables, and that is we assumed that rich people had it pretty good, and so they were going to pay the highest taxes, and that we were going to take that tax rate or the spoils of those taxes, and we were going to reinvest in people who were not only less talented but less fortunate and give them a shot. And it feels as if we've flipped the script. We've decided that our new idols are rich people and that they are the most noble and they should pay the lowest tax rate, thinking that if they're more productive, it'll unlock wealth. This kind of trickle-down theory. And it just hasn't panned out that way. It just hasn't worked. So this pandemic has only accelerated that. If you make more than $100,000, you've seen no change in unemployment rates, and there's a 60% likelihood you can work from home. If you make less than $40,000, 40% have had some sort of job interruption, and there's less than a 10% likelihood you can work from home. So what we have in America is, the reality is, if you're in the top 10%, if you're in the top decile, and you don't like to say this out loud, and you've been blessed with good health, no one, you or nobody you love has contracted the novel coronavirus, or you're healthy and are able to endure it pretty easily, you're living your best life. If someone had come to me and said 6 months ago, Scott, you're not going to commute. I commute to New York every week. I was spending 10 to 15 hours a week commuting. You're going to be able to teach, advise companies, do your speaking engagements, everything you do, and you're going to be able to do it from home because all your clients, your publisher, everybody, your students are fine with you doing it remotely. And, oh, by the way, you're never going to be wealthier. Your stocks are going to skyrocket. And it means, okay, more time with family, more time with Netflix, and wealthier? Sign me up. And that's the life of the top 10% in America right now. Life's never been this good.
Yeah, kind of that K-shaped recovery.
100%. And then the other 90% have said, okay, I'm strained. Maybe I've had an interruption, either mine or my wife's income. Maybe I have to put myself in harm's way and go to a place-based job because I can't work remotely. So I have to expose myself to COVID-19. Maybe I'm not quite as secure. I don't have access to the best health care. My home isn't as nice. My kid in remote learning, maybe our broadband isn't as stable. And you've seen just the other 90% kind of just start to really struggle. And it's creating incredible strain, both financial and emotional, on American households. And so is that the world we want to live in? Whereas I think a lot of nations, including Australia, have said, all right, we're going to try and, you know, either work through corporations and guarantee people will get 60, 80, 100% of their current income or increase unemployment. What we've done in the U.S. is we've said, okay, if you're a small business, we need to save you. I mean, the perfect example is in New York, we've made a huge effort to keep restaurants open, but the schools are closed. You know, it just makes no sense.
Yeah.
A restaurant closing is meaningfully bad, but schools closing is profoundly bad. I mean, ask anyone who has a 9-year-old at home right now. My two kids are home because somebody tested positive at their school, so they're both doing remote learning. Everything comes off the tracks. Mom has to be home. She's angry. Remote learning is not good for a 10-year-old. He needs socialization. He needs structure. Mom ends up sitting next to him to make sure he's actually doing his work. You know, these kids need socialization. So anyway, I think that this pandemic has revealed that our elected leaders have largely been, I don't want to say co-opted, but have too much influence from what I'd call the shareholder class. Yep. And we used to have a lot more empathy. There's supposedly a third of young people in America believe that communism is a better system. And what they're really saying is they think capitalism is a bad system. And I would argue they're not really witnessing true capitalism. Capitalism is you have full body contact, violence, and hand-to-hand combat competition at a corporate level. You let Apple put Sun Microsystems out of business. You let Google push media companies out of business. And that competition and innovation and stress unlocks tremendous prosperity. And when then we take that some of that prosperity and we use it to fund Social Security and Medicaid and Head Start and nutrition for kids from low-income households, we're sort of Darwinian and harsh on corporations, but generous and empathetic to people. What we've seen over the last 20 years and what this pandemic reveals is we've flipped the script and we've decided that companies are people and we need to bail them out and we need to be more forgiving of them, and that people are responsible for their own lives. And if you have to pile your Diet Cokes and your diabetes medication into an igloo and head out as an Uber driver, well, look, I'm sorry, you fucked up. You have to take responsibility for putting yourself in that position. And capitalism can't survive that way. Capitalism is not an organic state. It's not a natural state. And if it doesn't rest on a pool of empathy, if we don't elect leaders that, quite frankly, redistribute the spoils of the most successful companies and the most successful people, it just collapses on itself. And so I would argue that capitalism, that young people haven't really seen it. What they're seeing is capitalism on the way up, and then socialism on the way down, where we bail out companies. And that's cronyism.
Yep.
So we don't even have socialism. I'm not a socialist. I'm a capitalist. But 7 of the 10 countries with the happiest people are socialists because they don't make as much money, but they don't have the fear of finding out that their wife has lung cancer, which means they're going to go bankrupt. That's what we have in the U.S. Healthcare has become so expensive that you can be a middle-class family, and if someone gets deathly ill, it might mean bankruptcy. So a lot of socialist nations have that absence of fear. They have that absence of fear that their kid won't be able to go to college if she plays by the rules and she's good. She will get to go to college. That is not the way we roll in the U.S. We believe in winners and losers, and I actually think that's a good thing. The question is, has it gone from winners and losers in capitalism to the Hunger Games, where it's you either get to the top 1% or you die trying? And I think we've just gone too far here, and this pandemic has accelerated these trends. We're no longer living in a dysfunctional economy. We're living in a dystopian one, and it's really, quite frankly, I think we're going to look back on this, and it's going to reveal some very ugly attributes regarding the U.S., not only what our priorities are, but in addition to just how we handled the crisis.
We have spoken about many of the problems that COVID has caused, and which you've just touched on then. And I don't want to speak about all the problems. There's more throughout the book about how the economy and business is being affected. But I also want to touch on some of the solutions that you identify in the book. And what are some of the initiatives we should take to fight the pandemic and create a better future, Scott?
Well, when I think about what's happened in the United States, and I don't know if it's as true in Australia, but in the 60s and 70s, we had a lot of remarkable legislation that was accomplished on a bipartisan level, whether it was the Clean Water Act or civil rights legislation. And I think a lot of it was because the people, our elected leaders, didn't think red, Republican, didn't think blue, Democrat. They thought red, white, and blue because they had all served in the same uniform in the agency of the flag. And now we don't have that collective connected tissue in our society. And I wonder if it's an opportunity, especially with the need for testing and tracing and the fact that so many of our communities are low income now, if there's an opportunity to return to national service and have what I loosely term a Corona Corps, where kids are encouraged to take a gap year between high school and college. And if they do something in public service, they get additional student relief for college, or maybe they get a lower interest down payment or financing for a mortgage. But we have to find a connective tissue that creates more of a common bond, because what's happening in a pandemic, and to a certain extent a lot of it will exist post-vaccine, is that we're no longer going to malls, we're no longer going to movie theaters, we're no longer commuting, we're no longer meeting each other in school. So we have less empathy. There's studies that show that when you live in a community, when you bump into people purposely or happenstance or in different economic classes, different backgrounds, different sexual orientation, you develop more empathy for them. But when you're segregated, when certain classes become more powerful or more populous, whether it's Algerian immigrants in France or gay people wanting more rights, you resent them. And that is what is happening in America. We no longer have opportunities, or as many to say, there by the grace of God go I. We're not commuting to work, so we don't see the mentally ill homeless vet panhandling. We don't see the single mom bringing us our lunch. You know, we don't see the Hispanic immigrant drying our car at the car wash. All we see is our family and the guy dropping off, you know, the guy in the Amazon van. And so if we're not at malls and we're not at movie theaters, are we really a nation? Are we having the opportunity to develop empathy? We're entering sort of this period of this empathy vacuum. And it's kind of led to this I've got mine, get yours kind of attitude.
Yeah, where living in bubbles. Yeah,
living in bubbles, not really wanting to help each other. And it's really, I think it's really dangerous. So you asked, I think it all starts first with national service. I think even there's great examples. Mormons go on mission. The Peace Corps, national service or conscription, in the armed services. I think all of these things, serving in the agency of your country, serving in the agency of others, create a level of camaraderie and respect for the country that we are really desperately missing in America right now.
Scott, there are so many more questions that I could ask you about the book. It's a fantastic book. I highly recommend people go out and get it. It's got a bright orange cover, so it should jump out at the stores over here. Last time I checked, I think it was in the top 10 in New York Times. Have I got that correct?
Yeah, number 8 New York Times, number 6 Wall Street Journal for Business.
So, well done.
It's better to It's better to be lucky than good.
I had a look at who else you're competing with there, and yeah, you got Obama to deal with. So
Obama, Oprah. God damn it. What do they have? Fareed Zakaria? All these people are smarter and more talented than me. Other than that, they have nothing. They have nothing.
Matthew McConaughey, I think he was up there too.
Yeah. All right. He doesn't have much going on. That's what I'm competing against.
But before we go, Scott, I also know you're a big fan of CrossFit. And have you been able to keep that up over the last year?
Yeah, I'm taking part in the work from home trend. Just as there's work from home, there's workout from home. It's sort of a evidence of the pandemic. My CrossFit box closed down, and one of the co-owners now comes to my house and brings equipment with him and trains me. And that's a very privileged position. But I've tried to stay in shape. I know you're an athlete. I know you stay in great shape. I think it's a fantastic lesson. I think that Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, who's also has a doctorate in quantum chemistry, has stated that she believes 60 to 70% of the Western world will eventually get the novel coronavirus, which I thought just was shocking. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to do my best to distance. I'm going to wear a mask. I'm going to be smart. But just in case, I want to get my lungs in great shape. I think this is a great opportunity and a great excuse to just get fit. Because if you do come down, if you do contract this, I mean, we're still probably, depending on who you talk to, 1 to 6 months away from getting the distribution or actually getting the vaccine. If you do contract the novel coronavirus, I just don't think you're going to regret being in good shape. just if you look at this thing, it really does take out the weak. And so how do you prepare for it? Well, you distance and you mask and you get strong. So. Yeah. And you're an athlete, you know this, and I was an athlete, not at the same level as you, but in college, and fitness for me is my antidepressant. It's what kind of keeps me even keel. I'm doing it from home. I actually invested in CrossFit. It was just purchased, and I had a chance to invest in it, so we'll see. But yeah, every day the weights get heavier, but I can adjust for that. I make them lighter, but I'm that old guy doing CrossFit on his lawn.
No, good on you. I totally agree with everything you said. It's one thing to get fit, to keep your lungs strong and things like that. But for myself, it's been a stressful year. I've got a 4-year-old, a 3-year-old, and a pregnant wife. Got a lot going on. And
you got a third on the way.
Yeah, got a third on the Scott. 2 weeks. 2 weeks to go. Oh, so,
You're in Vietnam.
Yeah,
you're in Vietnam.
Yeah.
You know what you don't realize now, but you realize when you get older, babies are awful. They're awful. Here's the thing. That's the bad news is they're awful. The good news is they get less awful. About the age of 3, they're actually reasonable, and then they start getting wonderful. And then about the age of 13, they turn into terrorists, constantly assessing the household for weaknesses and vulnerabilities and then striking at any given moment. But as you're seeing with your 4-year-old, you're going to have you got hand-to-hand combat for the next 2 to 3 years, but then it gets much better, and then you get a 10-year respite, and then it gets frightening again.
All right. Well, it's funny you said they hunt out the vulnerabilities and they attack then. Scott, I'm recording this podcast episode from home right now. It's at the time of recording, 8 a.m. here. So at a bit of a window in between preschool drop-off, daycare drop-off.
Yeah.
We had to have a chat beforehand. Listen, Dad's going to be upstairs. You can't come up here. I thought it was just a matter of time before my kids come barging in. So
people like that now. People are much more forgiving of that.
Yeah. Okay. Now. Good. Well, Scott, just to wrap it all up, I really look forward to the world opening up again. I look forward to the day that you're out here, Scott. Deep down, I know that you want to be an Australian.
I was born to be Australian. Look at Australians, right? They love sport. They're totally profane. They live on an island, the most beautiful beaches in the world, an incredible appreciation for camaraderie. I love when you get in a cab in Australia, you're expected to sit in the front seat. I mean, that just kind of says it all, right? So, yeah, I love Australia. I'm actually a huge fan of Melbourne. And by the way, I think you guys showed real leadership by shutting that shit down and distancing. And what do you know? You've had zero infections. Is that right?
Zero infections for 40 days. It wasn't easy. I'm incredibly proud of what we've been able to get through.
Yeah, and this is what happened, and I'm going to guess. 40 days ago, 60 days ago, people started yelling, this was tyranny. Well, guess what? You get to hug your kids. You get to take your wife to dinner. You get to spend time with your grandparents because Melbourne decided to embrace tyranny for about 10 days. And I think that's leadership.
Oh, so, sorry, no, it was about 3 or 4 months. It was quite a while. But the carrot that we've got is we're going to have Christmas together. Families are going to get together from all over the country.
I can't be around my grandparents.
Yeah.
I have to tell my grandparents. I don't have grandparents. I have to tell my in-laws they're not allowed into the house. They can't see their grandkids.
Yeah.
I mean, okay. Anyways, I think I've been following a little bit what's happened in Melbourne, but anyways, I'm a huge fan. I'm getting down there. I just love it. The reason why I'm on a podcast with an Australian rugby or whatever the hell they
Australian
call it
football.
Down there.
Australian football
is because I have such a, I'm not on the line with a Vietnamese cricket player right now. I'm just not, you know, I have huge affinity. My father, was born in Sydney and,
oh, really?
I've always thought and ended up immigrating back to Scotland when he was a baby. But I've always thought that someday me and my family would end up in Australia. I mean, geez, we'd all live there if it wasn't so goddamn far. We would all live there.
Yeah, it is far, but
worth it.
Exactly. Worth so, it. Scott, I look forward to the day that you can get back here and who knows what it could have been like if you did move here one day. Scott. Thanks very much for the time. I'm conscious it's late in the afternoon for you. So thanks very much for chatting on the Richards Report.
Thank you. Congrats on the new one. Or best of luck. Best wishes on the new one.
Thank you.
Hang in there with the other two. Hang in there.
Okay, that's it for another episode of the Richards Report. Thanks for listening in. Make sure you check out Scott's great book, Post Corona. If you liked this episode, but you missed out when Scott and I first caught up in New York last year, then make sure you go back and check out that episode. And make sure you subscribe as more episodes are on the way, including next episode where I'll be sitting down with Six Park co-CEO, Pat Garrett, as we do each quarter. Don't forget, show notes for the episode are available on the Six Park website. See you next time on The Richards Report.